Welcome to episode 152 of Primary Care Update. I'm Mark A. Bell, a family physician and editor-in-chief of Essential Evidence Plus.
I'm Kate Rowland, family physician and associate professor at Rush University.
I'm Gary Ferencik, a general internist and professor of medicine at Michigan State University.
Hi, I'm Henry Barry, a family physician and one of the co-founders of InfoPoems. We're recording 2 days after the eclipse, and I'm still recovering. Okay, listeners, show of hands, how many of you were in the totality zone and were able to go out and watch the eclipse?
Gosh, that's not very many, Henry.
Not as many as I would have expected. This was just spectacular. My wife and I went out to this little town on Lake Erie, just east of Sandusky, and awesome, spectacular, magical. I don't know, words just can't really describe the whole experience. The little village that we were in had just beautiful Victorians homes and lovely gardens and spring bloom. And then there was this causeway out into this marshy area where there's all kinds of wildlife. And, you know, right after the totality, when the sun was starting to come back alive, there was just hundreds and hundreds of terns flying in formation and doing those things that are called murmurations, you know, how they change formations and stuff while in flight. It was just spectacular.
Well, I'm reminded of something my father, my dour German father, said many years ago. You've seen one sunset, you've seen them all. That's how I feel about total eclipse.
But you know, if you've never experienced a total eclipse, the next one in the U.S. is going to be in 20 years.
And
but
he really did say that. He really did say that. Okay, all right. Yeah. On this podcast, we highlight poems or patient-oriented evidence that matters. If you want to get all of them, one a day, you've got to subscribe to Essential Evidence Plus. You get a poem in your email plus a great primary care reference. EssentialEvidencePlus.com. The opinions expressed on Primary Care Update are those of the commentators, and this podcast doesn't represent medical advice or the endorsement of any products. You can get CME credit, go to IAFP.com. The Illinois Academy will give you half credit for answering a few questions. You go to their online IAFP education webpage. So this week, we are going to discuss SGLT2 inhibitors for older adults and frail adults with heart failure, long-term outcomes of bariatric surgery in adults with type 2 diabetes, the duration of antibiotics for febrile UTI in kids is longer better, and real-world outcomes of lung cancer screening. Kate, get us started, please.
Yeah, I sure will. I have an interesting study this week asking whether SGLT2 inhibitors lead to patient-oriented outcomes in adults with frailty or adults over age 65. So these authors searched multiple databases and registries to identify RCTs or observational studies that compared SGLT2 inhibitors with either a placebo or another active agent in adults who are either frail or over age 65. Sorry that that's a combination category, guys. They included 20 studies involving more than 77,000 participants with type 2 diabetes and heart failure. The SGLT2 inhibitors included, get ready, and I apologize in advance for how I'm going to stagger over these medications, empagliflozin, canagliflozin, dapagliflozin, that all seems fine, as well as sotagliflozin, which I'll talk about at one of our upcoming live courses, luseogliflozin, lecoglyphlozin, and ipagragliflozin. All medications I've never heard of or prescribed, but included
in this
study.
You were on a pretty good roll there.
Yeah, that's important because they include about half of the trials were on medications that I have never heard of or prescribed. Anyways, in the full meta-analysis, there was no significant difference in glycemic control. There was one trial that found that the SGLT2 inhibitors resulted in significantly worse glycemic control. This study compared canagliflozin to glimepiride, found no change with the SGLT2 and a 0.3% reduction with the sulfonylurea. Once this trial was removed in sensitivity analysis, which is not unusual, is an action that I have some questions about because they left it out in the final analysis. The net effect was that the SGLT2 inhibitors were associated with a small but statistically significant improvement in glycemic control. So as long as you just remove the data that makes your study, anyways. The SGLT2 inhibitors were also associated with fewer deaths from any cause, although there was no significant difference when you only included the randomized trials, when they removed the observational studies. SGLT2 inhibitors were associated with fewer cardiac deaths, that was consistent independent of study design, also associated with fewer hospitalizations for heart failure. That's not unexpected given what we know. They were also not associated with certain other outcomes that they looked at, such as coronary events, cerebral vascular events, worsening of renal function, which was important, heart failure, or, good news, not associated with a worsening incidence of diabetic ketoacidosis. The info about the change in A1C not being dramatic or not being significant at all should not actually be surprising. Empagliflozin, among the more commonly prescribed meds, is associated with a 0.6 to 0.7% reduction in A1C, and sotagliflozin could not pass phase 3 trials based on A1C reduction. It's an interesting med that I will go into a deep, deep rabbit hole about in our live course this week, and I'm happy to talk about at any time. It's now approved for people who have type 2 diabetes and heart failure based on the heart failure indication alone. It's actually not based, it does not have an indication based on the type 2 diabetes treatment indication. So anyways, the SGLT2 inhibitors that work for heart failure in people with diabetes are also effective in older adults and people with frailty. And that is the bottom line here.
Pretty sure all people that are 65 are frail, aren't they? Henry, go ahead. Chime in here.
Yeah, so this is what I call a kitchen sink systematic review, because they included randomized trials, case control studies, cohort studies. Only half of them were randomized trials. So there should be no surprise whatsoever that there was heterogeneity in the data. And there should be no surprise whatsoever that there were some outliers and why they did this crazy sensitivity analysis. And they did some other kind of hinky things. So the author said that the risk of bias was generally low. And yet in the randomized trials, for example, half of them had insufficient blinding of the participants. Half of them had insufficient blinding as to the outcome measures. There was some selective reporting. So there was just a lot of goofy stuff in their whole process here. So, you know, I've never been a great fan of A1C as a marker. It's convenient and it's measurable, but, you know, I'm more concerned about patient symptoms and the outcomes. And so, you know, the data for me on this with regards to all-cause mortality and heart failure are much more compelling. And I think the randomized trial data probably show this a little bit better than some of the cohort studies.
Yeah, I agree. I think the RCTs are fairly robust with that outcome, total mortality and MACEs. And I think what you're talking about also, Kate, the relatively minimal effect on A1C has been shown study after study after study. So I think there's a separation between the glycemic effect of these drugs and their effects on macrovascular outcomes. So is it empagliflozin? Come on, we got to take a vote here.
I don't know.
I think it's empagliflozin. It depends on which syllable you put the emphasis on.
Yeah, so I mean, I think the issue around leaving the study out, there's something called a leave one out analysis, where when you see a lot of heterogeneity, when you have, you know, differing outcomes in different studies in a meta-analysis, one of the things you do is you see, well, where's that coming from? And so you do a leave one out analysis. You leave one out systematically, you know, each of the 20 studies, let's say. And that can be one way of reducing heterogeneity. And it sounds like they might have done that here. But I agree. I think throwing all these crazy glyphosins in there that never got FDA approved, mixing up randomized trials with observational studies, I don't like that. I think they would have been better and given us better guidance if they would have been a little more selective about what they included, I guess.
All right, this is too much information, but I was reading this article and they gave the reference to the study that they excluded. And I linked to it and it turned out like 45 minutes later that was actually not the one that they excluded. It was different than the one that was in the forest plot. And it took me so long to figure out that the reference link was wrong. So if you happen to go to this article, everybody could know in advance, learn from my mistakes.
We all try to. Thanks, Kate. So we're going to do a quiz next. And in patients with minor ischemic stroke or TIA, so mild or minor ischemic stroke or TIA, does adding clopidogrel, Plavix, to aspirin for the first 10 to 21 days have any benefit? A, it reduces the risk of recurrent stroke with an NNT of 50, It reduces the risk of recurrent stroke with an NNT of 250, so not as good. Reduces all-cause mortality or stroke with an NNT of 50, or reduces all-cause mortality or stroke with an NNT of 250. Stay tuned. Henry, tell us about what bariatric surgery can do for our type 2 diabetic patients.
So this was a paper by Kirkoulis and colleagues published in JAMA just a few weeks ago, and it basically provides us with some long-term follow-up. So I've been kind of impressed with the bariatric surgery data. Now, granted, there's lots of observational studies showing the number of patients with type 2 diabetes who are cured, if you will, of their diabetes. What these authors tried to do is a collaborative pooling of individual patient data from four randomized trials. And so it's not all of the data that's out there that they pooled. It was just that these were the four that they could get. And it was only 300 participants. Okay, so four studies, small. The individuals had to have type 2 diabetes and a BMI between 27 and 45. And they were randomly assigned to bariatric surgery or standard medical and lifestyle management. Now, they followed the patients for a median of 11 years, and they had 86% follow-up on all of these individuals. Turns out that about a quarter of those who were randomized to medical treatment eventually got bariatric surgery, but they used the conservative intention to treat analysis. As I mentioned before, I don't really care about A1C levels. And in this case, what they showed us, though, is that, you know, at 7 years and at 12 years, the bariatric surgery group had lower A1C levels by about 1.5% and 1% respectively. So they had a number that was different. Okay, were they less symptomatic? I don't know. Were they having fewer complications? I couldn't tell you. However, what they also told us was that the mean weight loss for those individuals who had the bariatric surgery at 7 years was 20% versus 8% weight loss in the medical group. And at 12 years, though, things kind of started coming a little bit closer together, maybe because of the bleed over from those that got the bariatric surgery. But that was 20% versus 11%. What about meaningful outcomes? Things like cardiovascular events and all-cause mortality? No difference between the groups. And, oh, yeah, the individuals who had the bariatric surgery, they had a little bit higher rate of gastrointestinal issues, dumping syndrome, but also anemia and fractures. So this is a place where I was really excited to try to see these data and was hopeful, but now I'm wondering if maybe bariatric surgery is going to go by the wayside in favor of the SGLT2 inhibitors and the GLP-1 agonists. Mark, what do you think?
Well, I think that's a good point. I mean, as long as surgeons, can make money doing bariatric surgery, some of them are going to want to do it. And I think I was kind of surprised by the amount of weight loss in the control group, in the lifestyle group, because 10% is a lot. In most of the studies that I've seen, 3%, 4%, maybe 5%. So I was impressed by that. So that may be a bit of an outlier. I'm not sure. Probably underpowered for the cardiovascular outcomes, isn't it? I mean, with only 300 people, even if they're followed for 10 years, you'd expect a few events, but wouldn't surprise me if it was kind of underpowered. But yeah, it's a great point about the Ozempics of the world. Are you going to sing the jingle? Oh, whoa, whoa, Ozempic, Henry?
No.
No.
We don't want to lose any more listeners after that, because I just really want to talk about the eclipse.
Yeah, so we can tell. Anyway, I think that's, Ozempic and these other agents have their own set of side effects and adverse effects and are a lifetime, they're costly. You got to take them your whole life. Bariatric surgery is a one-time thing. So, I think there are pros and cons to each. And wouldn't it be great to see a randomized trial comparing the two? Maybe that's coming.
It's probably already underway.
Kate, what do you think?
Yeah, I think that trial is probably already underway. Yeah. I think that 25% that eventually got surgery is probably messing with this data. I think it is tough to randomize, especially with all that's changed in the last however many years that's been for those earliest trials, between 15 and 20 years later. And I do wonder if you took out the people who had surgery, how would those numbers look? in terms of the weight loss and the A1C changes. And I actually wonder if they did those analyses. But yeah, I think people who go into bariatric surgery know that it is not a, it's not a decision that is not without consequences, and including health consequences, significant health consequences. Mm-hmm. But that it is a, as they say, a significant lifestyle change. So.
Yep. Okay. Yeah. And the cost of these, weight loss drugs like Ozempic is about a tenth as much in European countries as it is here. So we are chumps for the and shills for the drug industry by saying, oh, that's fine. We can pay $5,000 while they pay $500 a year in the UK. Okay. All right. Grumpy. I'm going to go next. This is called 5 days of antibiotic treatment is an option for kids aged 3 months to 5 years with uncomplicated but febrile UTI. This was in Pediatrics 2024. Montini was the first author. And they ask if for kids with a febrile UTI, is 5 days of treatment as effective as 10 days to resolve symptoms and prevent recurrences? So they enrolled 142 kids aged 3 months to 5 years presenting to the emergency department who had signs of uncomplicated but febrile UTI. 13% of the participants had VCUR. The rest didn't. Kids were randomized, properly concealed allocation to get oral amoxicillin clavulanate or Augmentin for either 5 days or 10 days. Basically, they did the randomization after 3 or 4 days of therapy when they knew the cultures, so they could also balance the groups with regards to E. coli versus non-E. coli causes. The study used a non-inferiority approach to the analysis to see, was it non-inferior to get 5 days? And what they found was resolution of symptoms actually occurred in more than 90% of kids in both groups. The need for further antibiotic therapy was similar in both groups. Recurrence within 30 days was only 2.8% in kids who got 5 days of treatment, 14% if they got 10. So it's actually better if they got fewer days of antibiotics. Adverse events were pretty uncommon and were similar in both groups. So bottom line, in kids 3 months to 5 years with an uncomplicated febrile UTI, 5 days of antibiotics are as good as 10 and maybe even a little bit better. Gary.
I'm looking forward to the study that says 3 days versus 5 days, followed by the study that says, is 1 day as good as 3 days? How low can you go, Mark? In some ways, I don't know. I mean, I vividly remember when I was a resident, it was a study, it was in the New England Journal, is 5 days of bed rest for acute low back pain as good as 10 days? And it was. Turned out they didn't compare it to like 0 days or 1 day, yeah. So, I mean, I just wonder if I think we've also established this with community-acquired pneumonia and with some other, other infectious diseases.
Everything we've ever studied. Yeah, everything.
I know, it's just like we just...
As far as I know. In fact, in UTI in men, there was a study, a poem last year, 7 days as good as 14, I think it was.
So, Mark, don't you have a comment about why did we choose 7 and 10 days?
If human beings had four digits, this would have been a study comparing 4 versus 8 days, okay? That's my take on it. Anyway, Kate, you got a comment on this? Someone who actually takes care of children.
I always enjoy that Gary weighs in first on the pediatric studies. No, I do not believe I have anything to add to this one.
Okay, good. Yeah.
And all of this, as Gary is pointing out, all of this is based on like our guess of like, I don't know, maybe 5 days. So any amount of evidence supplants our current practice because it's not like our current practice rests on any body of evidence at all.
Putting a bottle that has on the label antibiotic, doesn't even have to have pills in the bottle. Maybe that may be enough to give it to the patient, right?
But it's so ingrained, though. I mean, it's like it's part of our DNA. It's so hard to not think about 7 to 10 days or 7 to 14 days. And it's just, I don't know, it's just one of those things that I just think is like many things in medicine, we've accepted this over the years without a critical eye. So I'm happy.
And this isn't the first study that showed actually better outcomes with shorter courses of antibiotics in terms of recurrences and other things like that. So for other conditions, but great stuff. Gary, I think it's your turn to talk about lung cancer.
Well, and I'm lumping this together with, it doesn't matter what we do, there's downside. And that's kind of one of my themes when I'm talking about medicine. And, when we look at screening, it's really easy to do the screening test for most circumstances when it's quote unquote appropriate. All the harm comes after the screening test comes back, and particularly if there's some positive result. And, you know, we're used to thinking about this with PSA and perhaps some other screening modalities as well. And this struck got my attention only because of the fact that it's another one in the pantheon of be careful what you wish for. There's potential harm, but there's also potential downside, which I think commonly patients aren't aware of. So this made me go through the study and just explicate it a little bit more. So the article is entitled "The Rates of Downstream Procedures and Complications Associated with Lung Cancer Screening in Routine Clinical Practice." And the research question really was essentially that. And they tried to compare some of these complications and downstream repeat imaging studies to what they found in the original studies that were obviously under much more controlled circumstances. It was a retrospective cohort involving five U.S. healthcare systems focusing on individuals who underwent a baseline low-density or low-dose CT scan for lung cancer screening between the years of 2014 and 2018. It looked at all the downstream imaging, the diagnostic procedures that came as a result of the imaging, and any procedural complications. There were just about 9,200 patients who were screened during this period of time in these five healthcare settings. Turns out about 16%, so think about one in six, is going to have an abnormality on their CT scan. Some of them are going to turn out to be lung cancer. So turned out 140 patients were diagnosed with lung cancer. So that's the upside. That's the good side of screening. And this occurred within 12 months of getting the actual screen. They also found substantial rates of downstream imaging. About one third of the time, patients had to have subsequent imaging studies done. And I know that the common current paradigm is to have, I think, two 12-month apart screenings, and if it's negative, then you can spread them out a little bit more. But also invasive procedures. 2.8% of the patients, or 259 patients, had an invasive procedure. Why do I bring up that number? Because 140 were diagnosed with lung cancer. However, 259 ended up having either a needle biopsy or bronchoscopy. The patients who underwent an invasive procedure experienced relatively high rates of complications. 30% of the patients who had a procedure had a complication, and 20% ended up having a major complication, such as a cardiac arrest, lung collapse, or acute respiratory failure. They made the point here, and I didn't put the numbers down, so I don't remember, but these numbers of downstream complications were much higher in this real-world study than they were in the randomized control trial that looked at this initially. And so I think the bottom line for me is, yet again, reminding our patients that, yes, these procedures can be extremely helpful. On the other hand, there is potential for downside. There's overdiagnosis, there's finding incidental omas, there's the possibility of invasive procedures. And at the end of all this, you may not have the condition we're screening for, but only have been exposed to all of the invasive procedures that were needed to actually rule that out. So long story short, I do think this is a useful primary care study so that we can at least help balance the risks and benefits with our patients. And by the way, only 1% of the patients who were screened, I think even less than that, 1.5%, ended up having lung cancer. So most of the positive studies were false positives.
Kate?
As is always true in a screening study, unfortunately. Correct. Yeah, no, I think, when lung cancer screening first became the thing that we did, and I think this is actually still true, when I order a lung cancer screening test, I have to click a box that says documentation of informed, decision making or shared decision making is present, exactly for this reason, because there is a substantial downside. And I think it's actually interesting that we don't do that with other kinds of screening studies for which there is a downside. There's a chance that you're going to undergo a invasive procedure that may have some complication rate. Yeah, I agree. 20% for major complications for a not insubstantial number of procedures seems high. That seems a lot higher than I would have expected, and certainly higher than I currently counsel people. But I remember those first, the first studies that came out that said, yeah, this is probably worth your while. I think it was somewhere around 10 to 20% had additional imaging, and 30% or so of those had an invasive procedure of some kind.
Well, these are higher rates than I've seen in some other studies that have looked at the same things, how it's implemented in the community. Henry?
Yeah, so I share your thoughts about the importance of shared decision making, and I think this really underscores the wisdom of the Medicare requirement when it first came out. If we're going to pay for this, you have to go through a shared decision making because of just this set of consequences. So I wonder, and Mark, you might know this, I've got a couple of questions related to this. What do we know about the quality of the shared decision making that patients who go through screenings?
Hey, can you check the box? Come on, can you check the box? It must be good, right?
It's a very nice
box. She checked it.
I'm excellent at box checking. I'll have you know. Yeah.
So, one of the best.
And then the other question then comes, what happens with regards to the second round of screening? How many participants, how many first-timers go on to do this a second time? And what happens with the shared decision-making, the second step? So, Mark, yeah. I think there's some opportunities for maybe some really cool process studies.
Well, certainly, you know, I think it's great, as Gary mentioned, that we're starting to think about spacing them out because nobody wants to do this every year. And it kind of makes sense. Maybe do it 2 1-year apart, but then after that, 18 months, 24 months, because the yield is much, much lower of interval cancers once you get through that initial screening. Most of the cancers that you're going to find in the next 5 years are on that first screening. So spreading it out reduces the risk of potential harms, hopefully. And of course, not all 140 who were diagnosed with lung cancer benefited from that early diagnosis. You know, the number needed to screen that we know of is from the trials is about 200 over 5 years. So for every 200 people you screen for 5 years, you prevent one death due to lung cancer in the trials. But here, with that complication rate, that may not be quite as...
Yeah, they didn't really look at mortality either. They just said diagnosis. You know, I think the assumption, and that's a great point, Mark, the assumption is if they were diagnosed, they were better off. Well, maybe they weren't.
Yeah. Knowing I have stage 3 lung cancer a little earlier ain't going to, you know, where's the benefit there? So certainly some patients, you know, the trials would suggest that there is a benefit, but again, also has to be balanced against the harm. So, all right, great. Henry, you got anything else to add?
Nope.
All set. Okay. So quiz answer time in patients with minor ischemic stroke or TIA. Does adding Plavix or clopidogrel to aspirin for 10 to 21 days have a benefit? And if so, what is it? Is it reducing the risk of recurrent stroke with an NNT of 50 or 250? Or is it reducing all-cause mortality or stroke with an NNT of 50 or 250? So the 2018 meta-analysis by Hao and colleagues in the BMJ, HAO, Hao and colleagues, identified 3 good quality randomized trials, over 10,000 patients total. And they ran each of these studies randomized these patients to aspirin only or clopidogrel plus aspirin after this TIA and followed them for 10 to 21 days. If it was also so started within 24 hours of symptoms, when started within 24 hours of symptoms, adding clopidogrel had no effect on all-cause mortality, but it did reduce the risk of non-fatal recurrent stroke by about 2%, so an NNT of 50. The benefit was biggest in those first 10 days of treatment. Little additional benefit if you went out beyond 21 days. There was a very small increase in the likelihood of major extracranial bleeding, 0.2%. So for every 10 strokes you prevented, there was one additional extracranial bleed. So the answer was A, reduce the risk of recurrent stroke with an NNT of 50 started within 24 hours. All right, we are done. Again, go to the IAFP.com site for the Illinois Academy, and they will give you CME credit if you're interested. We really appreciate you tuning in and listening to us go on and bloviate and talk about our things we found interesting here. We hope you enjoy it. Tell your friends about our podcast. Go to our course. A reminder, that course is April 12th in Naperville. Rhymes with Paperville and Caperville and Vaporville and lots of other things. So hopefully you can join us there. Tell your friends and we'll talk to you soon with more primary care updates.